First, I'll make an introduction. This is Paul Rodell again, IBS Oral History Project. It is now the afternoon of the 20th, and I'm in the home of Tom Fox, who was in Vietnam 1966 through 68 doing refugee work, and we'll get into that in a little bit, and a bunch of other things. But first, I just told you before turning on the tape that we do some background things first, who the people are, when and where you were born, how you were raised, something about your parents and the influences on you as a young person to get you up to the point of wanting to join something.
Right.
So now I can let it go to you.
Okay. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was the third of six children. My father was a professor of anatomy at Marquette University Medical School. And my mother was a housemaker. My father was a very, very bright academic, neuroanatomist. My mother was more of a simple person, but she was the heart of the family. She took the traditional role of raising the children. My father was... she ran the house and raised us, but my father's vision, I think, had a very big role in our lives. He really believed in academics and wanted his children to go to college, and he wanted his boys especially to go to the best colleges they could go to. My father was a hardcore Democrat, Adlai Stevenson. I wore Adlai Stevenson buttons when I was 6 years old.
Okay.
And he loved Adlai Stevenson for what he stood for, and also because he was a very articulate person.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was what would be called a commonweal Catholic or a progressive Catholic. Mother was Catholic as well, more of a pious, traditional Catholic. And so my older brother went to Harvard, and I was also a jock in high school, a good football and baseball player. I went to Stanford University on a football scholarship, and after my freshman year at Stanford University, I was asked by the dean of men, Dwight Clark, who runs VIA, if I wanted to go to Hong Kong for the summer to work with refugees at Rennie's Mills, a refugee camp in the New Territories.
So what year was that again?
That was in a graduate 62. That was in the summer of 63.
Okay.
And I was one of about 20 people who was invited to go. And so I went to see the football coach, and he told me he had advised me not to go because he said I wouldn't be in good condition when I came back. And I said I thought I would be, and I had to decide between football and Asia. And
mm-hmm.
I decided to go to Asia and drop football. Fortunately, while I was there, I picked up an academic scholarship. So, but anyhow, I made the decision to drop football at Stanford, and I really did find the summer in Asia, in Japan, Taiwan, and Hong Kong to be very formational. And working with refugees in the New Territories was also my first experience of really working with poor people and in Asia people. And I guess I fell in love with Asia in a way that I didn't quite understand at the time. But I went to France my junior year,
mm-hmm.
and I remember picking up the Le Monde and seeing the headline in Le Monde, and it was in French, but it was I couldn't tell you the month or when, but it was in French, and it said, American airplanes bomb Hanoi, or Haiphong. And I didn't know where Haiphong was, or Hanoi, never heard of the place. But I just remember how repulsed I was, and how, you know, I just felt it was impossible. I couldn't believe that an American airplane was bombing anyone, but it was in a French newspaper, and so I remember struggling through the article to try to find out. This was sometime in 65, I guess. And so the first time I ever came across the word Vietnam, or Indochina, I think it was, I knew that I opposed American power. policy, whatever was going on, but that was my first, it wasn't like I had to learn, it was like there was something deeper in me that said this is wrong.
And it was related to the experience of working with the refugees?
I don't know. It was just, it was maybe related as much to the upraising that you don't bomb anyone. You just don't go in airplanes and bomb people. And especially, that's not what I really believed in America's ideals and America's, that America was a democracy and goodness and I was very idealistic, and the Kennedy years were very formative, and I campaigned for John F. Kennedy, and I shook his hand, and I worked with him. My father was still working, pushing Adlai Stevenson. He didn't like the fact that I was pushing Kennedy, but I really was attracted to Kennedy, and then when Kennedy was elected, I really felt that the America was, it was right. It didn't, it made perfect sense. This is what was happening in America. I think the assassination of Kennedy took place, I guess it's in my freshman or my sophomore year, but and it was, I was stunned and saddened enormously.
Well, he started college in 62, it would have been your
sophomore year. Yeah, my sophomore year probably makes sense. And I was just so saddened, I couldn't believe it. And so I think that if you take my father's very, very progressive mindset, and my upbringing as a Catholic, and the sense of the idealism of the Kennedy experience, sort of the innocence of the late 50s and early 60s, and my refugee experience in Asia, all of that taken together had created a kind of young, very idealistic person. And then to encounter the bombing of some place on Earth, Landoshin, you know, I couldn't tell you where. I didn't know where Landoshin was. But there was this bombing occurred, and it just was very, very upsetting to me. And I remember going around to other students in France, American students who were living there at Stanford in France with me, and I was just so upset. And they were not upset. I mean, I realized something else was going on, because why wouldn't they be upset? And somehow it didn't upset others as much as it upset me, but it upset me deeply. And so after I went back to Stanford, finished out my junior year in Stanford, my senior year, there was a lot of activity on campus. There were teach-ins, and I was also a pretty good friend of David Harris, and we were close, and he was very active, and I was finding myself, my politics were getting more and more radical, I just remember the there was a period of my senior year in which they stopped the bombing of Hanoi for a lull, allegedly trying to bring the peace talks about, and then when it didn't happen, they started the bombing again, and I was so deeply upset when they started the bombing of Vietnam again, that I remember entertaining, and I can't tell you how seriously, but I do remember entertaining the thought of self-immolation as a kind of protest of some kind, and this was going on
as
the monks were doing at the same time. It was, you know, 60, whenever it was. I just remember that there was. I was saying to myself, and again, I'm not saying that how serious it was, but even to think that the pattern of self-immolation that I had seen in Vietnam made a kind of sense. I showed, and that I could relate to that. When looking back, made me think of how deeply it was, a kind of how deeply I was involved in this psychologically, and it was perhaps, one could argue that it was a very, very unhealthy involvement. One could also say it was a very healthy reaction to a very, very unhealthy development, which was this immoral militarism that was going on. But I went to every teach-in. I went to everything I could possibly consume. I was reading the Vietnam Reader, documents on Vietnam, Marcus Raskin. I mean, I could, and the two Vietnams, Bernard Fall, the early books, The Making of the Quagmire. I was doing all the reading I possibly could on mm-hmm. Vietnam, and the more I read about it, the more alienated I got. And meanwhile, I think that I knew that what am I going to do after I graduate? And well, I thought that it made sense for me to do what everyone was doing, or a lot of people were doing at that time, was to go and join the Peace Corps. And I was thinking of joining the Peace Corps. In fact, I did apply to the Peace Corps. But there was a professor of political science, I think his name is Bush, and I think it was Bush, but he said he had heard of this organization called International Voluntary Services, and and he could put me in touch with them because they were doing the same work in Vietnam, and perhaps I would find Vietnam more interesting. And so I applied to Vietnam, I applied to IDS, and I applied to the Peace Corps, and I was accepted to both.
Uh-huh.
And I was accepted to teach English in Thailand with the Peace Corps, and I was accepted to work with refugees in Vietnam. I think it was social work in Vietnam of some kind. And so it just seemed it made much more sense to go to Vietnam.
Even though Thailand was so close. And
well, no, they looked like the same distance to me. From California, Thailand and Vietnam were, you know, it's just which one do you want to go to?
No, I mean, that Thailand was still close to Vietnam, so you could observe it.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, yourself from it.
Right. It was, I felt that it would be more honest, because I was also thinking of the whole question of draft and what my relationship to the draft would be, and I kind of felt that the best thing I could do is just to confront the beast.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was toying with the idea of, am I a pacifist, am I not a pacifist, can a Catholic be a pacifist? Oh, and then they had, you know, the Catholic tradition of just war, and there was no place in the selected service for a Catholic to be pacifist, as it allegedly, and we didn't have the sophistication of some of the draft counseling that came later, but it really did. I sort of worked it out of my head that maybe within the Catholic tradition there is no way out of this except to do service. And I said I couldn't carry a gun, so
mm-hmm.
should I volunteer into the army and then do the medical stuff? And Vietnam and IDS seemed to be the most honest and the best way for me to do it, and also it seemed to be the most interesting thing to do. So I applied to Vietnam.
Interesting, what way? Because you couldn't work with social issues in Vietnam?
Interesting, because this was the center of all detention. I was reading,
okay.
I was just reading about, everything I could do was read about Vietnam, go to
mm-hmm.
all the teach-ins,
right.
And now I had the opportunity to actually go to Vietnam.
So it wasn't necessarily IDF as an organization or the jobs particularly that they were offering to you, but the country that they were offering to you.
I think part of it was the country,
uh-huh.
and part of it was, I think they had said that I would work with refugees, and part of it was that this just seemed to be the way that as a young person I could make a contribution. I mean,
right.
And I was thinking that if I went to Vietnam, no one would say, you're afraid to go to Vietnam.
Right.
And if I volunteered to go for 2 years, no one could say, you know, you're avoiding the draft for one.
Right, yeah, you've done double time.
And so it's like, I have no problem with going to Vietnam. I just don't want to go in the army. And
right.
I have no problem, you know, I'll go to the middle of any war area, but I just am not going to go in the army because I don't believe in it. And I felt that my honest response would be to try to go as a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
And as a volunteer, and the word volunteer is a very sacred word. It's an important word, and I sort of picked it up with volunteers in Asia, and then international voluntary services. And so the word voluntary meant a lot to me. I mean, it meant that you're really not going in there to stash away a bundle,
mm-hmm.
tax-free, but you're going in there because you feel that this is your way of serving, and your way of just doing something.
Mm.
Okay, so I was accepted, and then I accepted to go to Vietnam, and Stanford goes late. It starts late and it ends late because it's on the trimester, and
so are we.
And so we, I think it was like our graduation ceremony was not until like June 14th or so, but I had to be I had to be in training for IBS like 2 weeks earlier, a week earlier. So I never went to my own commencement at Stanford. I graduated, then I flew out to Washington to be, I guess, to go through the thing, to meet in Washington, and then from there we flew back to the Philippines and spent 2 weeks going through orientation in the Philippines, and then flew to Saigon and did 1 month of intensive Vietnamese. No, it was not. We went to Saigon for, I guess, a few days, and then went to Nha Trang, and I did 1 month of intensive Vietnamese in Nha Trang.
What did you do in the Philippines?
It was like, just like orientation, going and learning about, it was going there and learning Asian customs,
okay.
and just traveling a little bit, but it was more of a just acclimatizing to a tropical kind of situation. And
taking off the edge of culture shock,
I think,
for
so.
Most people.
I think
you'd been to Hong Kong already.
Right, but
so
it was part of the package of how you entered IBS, as I recall. I just remember spending time in a week in the Philippines,
mm-hmm.
but it was a Philippine kind of time when we were learning, you know, basic agriculture and basic whatever, you know, the statistics of Vietnam were or whatever.
And eating rice,
exactly. Yeah, sort of that kind of thing.
Yeah. And seeing poverty and wealth side by side and all of that.
A little bit of that.
Yeah.
But
not as much as labor. But
no, yeah. And then, but in the Philippines, we were outside of Manila, and it was like in the tropical, you know, forest or something, and it was really very lush. And
mm-hmm.
I just remembered how, I just couldn't believe how big the trees and how large the plants were. That was what
yeah.
I think. And so then we went to Vietnam, and when I was in Nha Trang, I was assigned to go to Tuy Hoa with a Filipino named Lucielo Ramirez, Nonoy they call him, Nonoy Ramirez. And he and John Pope and I were assigned to go to Tuy Hoa, and John Pope was going to teach English, and I think Nonoy was going to work with agriculture, and I was going to work with refugees. And we lived together for 2 years in Tuy Hoa and doing our thing. And my thing was to work in two refugee camps. One was north of the city and one was south of the city. The north of the city was Ninh Thinh refugee camp, and south of the city was Dum Thach. And they were, these were Vietnamese families whose villages were bombed out, and so they brought them and resettled them on sand, essentially, in corrugated huts. Officially they were supposed to receive benefits for 6 months
mm-hmm.
as refugees, and then they would be considered resettled.
You kind of started your actual project by about like August of 66?
I think so. I think it was August 66 that I was starting.
Okay. I'm just trying to put
right.
the chronology.
August 66, I was probably entering Tuy Hoa.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, what I found was that these, they were called refugees, but they were resettled on sand in corrugated
mm-hmm.
huts. And I think one of them had about 3,000 or 4,000 in one place, and then several thousand, you know, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 in these long huts. And people,
yeah.
But they were just very, very poor. No, almost no men, from the ages of 18 to 40.
Okay.
It was mostly elderly people,
uh-huh.
women, and children.
Uh-huh.
The men were all either in the Viet Cong or in the Arvin forces. This area,
if they were still alive.
If they were still alive.
Yeah.
This area was in Fujian province, and it was immediately around Tuyua. Now, the map, I mean, anyone who would tell you anything about that area at that time would say that the Viet Cong controlled all of Fujian province, except for maybe the district capitals and the provincial capital of Tuyua.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. I mean, the Viet Cong controlled everything up to the edge of the city. That was just...
And had probably so many agents and other sympathizers
yeah.
in the city that it was only... They hadn't bothered yet.
They, but you just knew that anytime you... And the, but the refugee camps that I worked at were
uh-huh.
up and down the coast about 4 or 5 kilometers. Now, they were right on the coast, so in one sense, I guess they were safe. You could get there safely. And the other, it was really anybody's territory.
Uh-huh.
And I had my Vespa. I would ride to the camp in the morning, and most of the early months I was there, I was just trying to listen to people and talk to people and just try to learn to speak the language a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And then slowly, I think the first project I got into is that I was noticing there were a lot of kids with hair lifts. I never come across hair lifts in this country, but I was seeing dozens.
Yeah, once every great while.
Yeah, dozens of
yeah.
hairless. And I couldn't tell you if it was genetic, it was bad, it was defoliant, or if it was bad food, or not enough, malnutrition during childbirth, or whatever. But whatever it was. Meanwhile, there was a Korean medical team that moved into the Tuyua, really nice civilian people, and
mm-hmm.
these are Koreans, and nurses and doctors, and they were working in the province hospital. But as you probably know, the Vietnamese who needed the help the most were the people in the rural areas, but they were afraid to come into the city, and they didn't trust the cities. I think one of the insights that I gained is so fundamentally obvious that this was a war between the city people and the rural people. I mean, it was a war for the most part between the interests of the rural and the interests of the city. And to this point, I think that's the basic dynamics of the whole Vietnam War. And in the intellectuals and the money people and the commerce people controlled the cities, and the agricultural interests and the traditional way of life and the Viet Cong controlled the rural areas. But the so I spent a lot of time trying to convince the parents of these young children to allow their children to come into the city and to have the Korean medical team, which was really sitting in there without much work to do, operate on these kids to fix up their face.
Right.
And then I would, I have pictures of them, I guess. But then I would stay with them for the day and come visit them, and they'd stay in the hospital 2 or 3 days to make sure they weren't getting infected or something, and then they would return, and I would take them back, and then I would show the results after, I think it was like 2 to 3 weeks, they'd take the bandages off, and these people, their faces were just, instead of having these awful hair lifts, they would be sewn together and looking a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And I would then take the kids to show other parents, and pretty soon this could be yours. And I think that then we started doing more and more. And I think we maybe did between 75 and 100 hair lift operations
uh-huh.
in the first in about a 3 to 6 month period.
Wow.
And yeah, it's a lot.
Okay.
And maybe it's more like 50 or something, but it was a lot. There were,
mm-hmm.
there were people I was bringing in a lot. I mean, there were just, that's the thing I'm telling you, there was, I couldn't believe how many hair-ups there were.
You said dozens. That means like maybe 24.
Yeah.
You know, and you're talking like,
well, maybe, you know, I'm trying to give you, I think it was at least four dozen, but, you know, it could have been more.
Yeah.
And other people would then start coming in.
For other things as well?
Well, the word would get out that these Korean doctors were not, you know, because the Vietnamese, I think it was about the same time that the Korean Army was assigned to, it was 1967 that the Korean Army was assigned to pacify Korean province.
Okay.
And the Korean Army, the Americans were very, very bad, and the Koreans were worse.
Yeah, I know.
The Koreans were brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And they made points of just killing. And so the people in the countryside really feared the Koreans, more so than the Americans.
Yeah.
And so getting people to come in to be operated on by Koreans was not an easy task. And so so part of what I was doing was trying to find ways to liaison. And then also, the other thing I found that while these people, that they were supposed to receive supplies over a period of 6 months, but most of them never got those supplies because the supply distribution came, like, with trickle down. Even if they were assigned and even if they qualified for a certain amount of rice payments or bulgur wheat or whatever it was, as the supplies came from Saigon to Nha Trang at the airport in Saigon, of course someone would take some of it, and then they get to Nha Trang and then someone takes some of it, and then they get to the province capital and someone takes some of it, and then they get to the district capital and someone takes some of it, and then they get to the refugee chief and then he takes his part, and pretty soon by the time it gets to the refugees, there was nothing. They were not getting what they were supposed to get. And so I started complaining about the fact that they weren't getting their stuff. And I remember then that I was just, I was somewhat naive because I would tell the province chief advisor, the AID guy,
mm-hmm.
that, that there's massive corruption here.
Mm-hmm.
And naive little me thinks that, that by reporting it, it's going to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And he just seemed indifferent, totally, totally indifferent to the fact that these people weren't eating.
Mm-hmm.
And he
doesn't have a problem. So
well, but his attitude was, we're not here to feed these people. We're here to support the structure that is supposed to feed them. And that if it doesn't, well, you know, we can't force it because we're building a country, and we're building, and if we force them to do what we want, then we're not doing our role. We can only be there to advise them, and they're corrupt in any case, and you're not going to change things, and quit rocking the ship. And I was viewed almost from the time I arrived as a maverick and as a kind of radical who was not playing the game. And the game was, I don't know what the game was in their opinion, the game seemed to be just to be there to allegedly be building government and to be earning a lot of money and letting things go on the way that they are.
Pausing. That's it. I turned it back on again.
Okay, and so, anyhow, so in, I really was getting upset with what was going on, and so I remember writing a letter to Senator Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
I complained because I knew that he was head of the refugee committee.
Uh-huh.
Or the subcommittee in the Senate or whatever.
And this would be Ted Kennedy.
Ted Kennedy,
yeah.
And I think I asked Don Luce, is it okay if I wrote Kennedy?
Uh-huh.
And he said, sure, go ahead. I don't remember if I showed the letter to Don, but I wrote Kennedy.
And did you compare what you had seen in Hong Kong?
No, there was no, there was not. Hong Kong was a different experience in a way. You know, this was these needs were much greater. And I mean, I was in a refugee camp where people were starving to death. I had never encountered starvation before. I mean, I'm talking starvation. I'm talking about being dying.
Well,
and
that you could say, look, I worked in Hong Kong and I saw how that operated when Catholic Relief took all these people in and fed them and, you know, did work like this, and here we don't have anything like that.
Maybe I could have, but I don't remember ever talking about my Hong Kong experience. I remember saying, you know, I'm IVS, I came here to help. I believe that this is that what I was supposed to do is to help refugees.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm finding here is that this government is absolutely so corrupt that the food that it's supposed to be getting, the shelter that's supposed to be being delivered here, is not getting to the people. And when I complain, I'm told, don't rock the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I just want you to know what's going on.
The AID people found out about the letter?
I don't know. I mean, I don't recall if the AID people found out about the letter.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. But I do know that Kennedy decided to come to Vietnam for an inspection. And when he did, he made contact with Don Luce. And either Don Luce told him about me, and either he never read the letter and Don Luce told him about me, or he had read the letter and asked if he could see me
mm-hmm.
when he came.
I suspect he probably read the letter.
Yeah. And but when he came, Don Luce said, let's go out to eat with Kennedy. And and I think it was Buddy Wise. I mean, the curious thing is when I look back, I think the guy who was also with us ended up as president of NBC or something, and he was one of the people on the two or three people were very, very bright, and they were on the Kennedy subcommittee, and they ended up getting into other things, and I think one of them is now maybe the president or the former president of National Broadcasting Company or something.
It's just the way you put Don Luce's invitation to you to join Kennedy for dinner sounded so casual.
Yeah. Well, it was a... But we went to this restaurant. It was a nice restaurant. He had a back brace on.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize, you know, that he had his own, because I think he had been in an airplane crash or something. We had this dinner and I suspect, knowing what I know now and did not know then, was that I was becoming a marked person.
I'll pause.
In,
so you were a marked person. What do you mean by that?
I'm not sure, because I think marked in a way of being viewed by AID and by the establishment as a troublemaker.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think, and it was a kind of, it was a kind of politicization that came out of experience. It's not like I had a political, it's not that I had any kind of political plan to change the world. And that's
mm-hmm.
not what I mean by politics. But it was, you knew when you were in sync or you were out of sync with policy.
Yeah.
And I guess I became very, very aware that I was out of sync with policy when I was told, don't rock the boat.
Yeah.
Because I had to choose between allowing people to starve or rocking the boat. And I felt that I could have no other purpose
but then to ask for food for the starving people. But in asking for food, I had to also tell them why they weren't getting food.
Yeah.
And they weren't getting food because all the food that was being sent there was being sold on the market. And
to enrich the political allies that were supporting the American effort.
See, well, yeah, it's just, I mean, it was just like the Vietnamese would finally, whoever got, it was called the Hoi Lo system, and it was, it's just the way you do it. If anything that comes through, you take a piece of. I mean, that's the way it operates. That's the that's why you'd want to be part of a bureaucracy, because you get to take a part of what it is that crosses your desk. And if you're in a distribution system, then you get to be, that's why you want to be province chief. There's just a lot more stuff that comes across your desk, and you get to take a piece of anything.
Rice or bowl or wheat or whatever.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so, and then if you have six or seven layers of bureaucracy from the national level to the district level, then everyone along the way gets their piece. And the system, I guess, works if there's nothing to be passed, but if something's going to pass through, then all of a sudden it doesn't get there. It mm-hmm. just doesn't get there. And it's tolerable when you have a functioning system and you don't absolutely have to get things there. But if you have starving people, then you've got to allow for something to get through to them to eat.
Yeah.
And so I kept complaining that people weren't getting enough food, and or they weren't getting what they were supposed to get for having being declared refugees. They're supposed to get stuff for 6 months, aid for 6 months, and they didn't get it. So I think that I found that my politics grew out of a rejection of the status quo that was in place there. And what I found so appalling was that people, that American civilians there, accepted the status quo because they felt that was their job to do so. And that I think they didn't see the starvation and the local level the way I did, because a lot of them, I mean, I lived in Tuiwa in a little house that I rented. It was more like a garage, cement. It was just a block of cement with walls around it and stuff. And that was a house.
Mm-hmm.
And but they lived in an air-conditioned compound along the beach. And you know, the whole USAID group lived in this air-conditioned compound surrounded by barbed wire and with refrigerators and televisions and VCRs and beer as much as they wanted at any time and all the stuff.
Did you try inviting them to stay in your house with you for a couple of days?
Oh, no, never.
Would they accept it?
No, because they felt it was not secure. I mean, I was...
You're there.
Yeah. And I was
secure enough for you. What's their problem?
I was the fool. You know,
the
fool.
They didn't want to be stupid.
I didn't want to be stupid, and I didn't, I mean, they just knew
no
it.
No offense, but no. I mean, that's probably how they saw you.
They did.
Yeah.
And the fact that I didn't have a gun, I mean, mm-hmm. they couldn't, I mean.
What good would a gun have done?
Well, I mean, if someone's breaking into your house or something like that.
A gun might make you more of a target.
I know,
then.
But that's exactly, I mean, I felt that way. I felt that any association, any gun is going to be, is just, you know, it's, you know, we were told, I don't know if IVSers, I don't know if any IVSers, well, I guess some probably carried guns or had guns, but.
Jay did for a little while, and then he said, what the hell am I doing with this?
And I was offered guns, with all the best intentions.
Yeah.
And I said, no thanks, you know.
Yeah.
And I felt that would just make me more of a target. And anyhow, I wouldn't know how to use the damn thing.
Well, someone with a gun is a different kind of person than someone without.
Right. And I wore, in that time, I wore black pajamas. And I would get on to, and I would have a conical hat and black pajamas. I looked like a total nerd. I mean, looking back on it, I mean, it was, people, you know, I was in some ways trying to be someone I wasn't. And so uh-huh. from that point of view, I must have really looked like a fool. And I cannot tell you to this day if the refugees in the camp that I would go to when I would come in there with a conical hat and black pajamas respected me for that or felt that I was just the biggest fool. I do know that they invited me, they always invited me into their huts, and they were very, very gracious, and the only thing they could usually offer me was tea, hot tea, and occasionally some rice bread, like this. It's like a hard, crusty kind of thing, and you snaps very easily, and it's made up of rice, and because they didn't have any food, or very, very modest food.
Yeah.
And I remember, it was just like. And I really felt, I can honestly say that I felt that the refugees in the camps that I worked with, although I did very, very little, I mean, I had the only, it seemed to me the only gift, the only thing that I could really offer them was just my presence, and that there was someone outside who seemed to care, who cared enough to listen to them, who cared enough to try to learn their language, who cared enough to receive a cup of hot tea in a broken dish, and by taking the tea, I gave them, I think, it wasn't my intention. But it was more, but looking back upon them, I think that I gave them dignity because they were able to offer me something.
Yes.
And even if it was only tea, it was sacramental.
Uh-huh.
It was sacred. It was a very, very important thing. And then I would sit down with them and they would be so happy and we would laugh and talk, spend more time just talking to people and drinking the tea that they would offer. Probably that's the most that I ever did was just, but occasionally I would then come out and try to, and I started a sewing co-op. There were these, see, one of the things is that this one refugee camp was right on the outskirts of Air Force Base.
Uh-huh.
And the girls, most of the girls, or a lot of the girls, were becoming prostitutes.
Uh-huh.
The fastest way to make money. I mean,
absolutely.
They could make 100 times, maybe 500 times the money that their parents could make.
Yeah.
And so I think...
So much for the old family social structure.
So much for the social structure. And I think that the tradition in Vietnam, and this would be an important, if you don't know, you should know the Nguyen Du and the tale of Kim Vung...
The tale of Keo?
Yeah, the tale of Keo.
I have students read that.
Okay, and it really, because there is a whole tradition... and we say they became...
Of remaining true to yourself, even though you're selling
exactly,
your body.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And it's a way of... and so the parents, too, as well as the daughter, maintain a kind of integrity, even though they're becoming prostitutes. Because we hear prostitute and...
The word prostitute means selling yourself.
Exactly.
But not just in a body sense, it means the soul.
Exactly. And I think the difference in a kind of way was there is a tradition... in Vietnam in which you can sell your body without selling your soul.
So there could be even an official could be doing dirty things but thinking himself to be clean, because Nguyen Du himself was an official for the government and felt the external pressure on him.
Right, but with the girls there was a cost to it.
Yes, okay, I'm not trying to minimize their cost.
I know,
but
the cost was that it still brought great, great shame within the broader society.
Yeah.
And so within the context of the family, perhaps you could arrange it, but the other side of it was that you would have to, in a sense, divorce yourself from your family. Because you were bringing shame to the family, and so you, and but anyhow, so that's all cultural stuff. But I was trying to find a way to bring income into the refugee camp, for young girls.
Uh-huh.
And I was able to beg, borrow sewing machines, and I was able to get some conical hat forms, and I paid someone to teach other girls how to make conical hats. And we're talking now teaching girls who were between the ages of 9 and 13 or so.
I was going to say 10, 12.
Yeah, but 9 to 13, because this was the last age at which you could...
Before they went on market.
Yeah. And so I couldn't...
And even then, the 13 is already getting up.
Right. And I couldn't tell you if that stopped anyone or made any difference at all. But I do know that they had a lot of pride in what they were doing,
uh-huh.
and they were selling these conical hats, and so that was another little project that we did.
Did AID help in that at all?
I think they might have. I think the sewing machines might have come from AID. I cannot tell you for sure. They might have not. They a lot of times I found that there were other. I think that anytime AID, the only thing I saw AID doing was bulgur wheat. I mean, that was their big thing.
Did the people actually eat it?
No, I never saw. I never once did I see a Vietnamese eating bulgur wheat.
Okay.
What they would do is they would mix it and feed it to pigs.
To pigs, yeah.
And
same in the Philippines. Although sometimes the Negritos that I worked with made some pancakes.
Uh-huh. I never saw anyone eat bulgur, but you could. You could take the bulgur that was given to you and sell it so that you could get, and then you could have the money.
To a pig farmer.
To a pig farmer.
Yeah, right.
So if you didn't have a pig, you could sell it to a pig farmer.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was just a commodity.
Yeah.
It was just a big, I don't know why, I guess because we had a lot of bulgur wheat, but it would seem to me
yep.
that they should be sending rice over there or
well,
something.
It was farmers probably from this part of the world, and Nebraska, and you know, et cetera, who had bumper crops.
So my work was I achieved, in terms of looking at what I accomplished in terms of change, very very little. I mean, very little, except to be an alternative presence, in a way. And I don't know if it amounted to anything at all. I really do know that there were people who really appreciated me. And I remember yeah. one time an elderly woman, I came, because I would come back to my place in Tuiwat at lunch and then take a siesta and then go back out. And she came, she was a woman in about her 70s. She walked a couple kilometers during that lunch period to come to warn me not to go back into the camp that afternoon because the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese were in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that if I'd come back, I would be either abducted or killed. And so there were people who were out trying to protect me. And
just as if you were in a village.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that there were people, and I can, in some ways, you know when you're loved and when you're not.
Uh-huh.
And there were people that I loved, and there were people who loved me. And so those are very, very intimate and fond memories. But about every month or every 2 or 3 months, I would leave Tuiwa. And my work, and I would fly to either Nha Trang or to Saigon. And we would go to Nha Trang because there would be more IVS people there, and there was a larger IVS presence in Nha Trang, and it was a bigger province. And it was, you know, I was just in a hick town,
uh-huh.
and it got lonely in a way.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
And so in Nha Trang, you could go in there and you'd meet with other IBS people, and you would go out to a bar and drink or something, and
uh-huh.
and you would not, and you could, you'd probably you end up doing some of the crazy things that you would think are the worst things that the GIs would be doing there too, and you're acting like one bad American. The difference may be that you are at least not doing it in your, it's like you're you know, if you're going to go to a bar and have a drink and talk to the bar girls and stuff like that, you weren't doing it in your own hometown. I mean,
yeah, dirtying
your own place.
Your own yard.
Because the other thing is, these are difficult things to talk about, but for all of us, it was a very lonely kind of experience too.
Mm-hmm.
And you're out of your own culture, and you're out of your own social setting, and you're out of your own protection mechanisms. We live in our society. We know what you can do, what you cannot, what's right and what's wrong, because we grew up knowing those structures. And
right.
You get into Vietnam, and everything is on its head, and you have to almost figure out.
And it's at war too.
And it's at war, and you have to figure out almost on a daily basis what constitutes right and what constitutes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And
safe and unsafe.
Safe and unsafe. Is it wrong to go to a massage parlor in Nha Trang? Probably it is, but maybe it's not, you know. And
it's wrong to do it at your own place.
It's wrong to do it in your
especially
own place.
Especially if one of the girls is from a family that you're socializing with, or friends of the family that you're socializing
and the,
with.
I guess the other thing that I would like to say, if I'm going to be honest, is to say the Vietnam experience caused me, and I think others also, to find our own hypocrisy. And at one level, we're living by the highest of ideals. The highest of ideals. And at another level, you know, you're on a weekend, you're going out to a bar in Nha Trang and, you know, sitting around. And I mean, the difference was, I think that there was a difference in one way, and I might have to say this, that when we learned to speak Vietnamese, most of us learned to speak Vietnamese, and learning to speak Vietnamese, we ended up having lots of fun with Vietnamese. I could go and I could have fun. If I was ever talking to a bar girl, I could speak to her as a human being.
Uh-huh.
I would go in and I'd ask her about her family, and I would ask her about where she came from and how she got to be there, and what are the kind of things that are happening in her life, and what does she really think about working here, and what does she think about the Americans and all that. And you end up having a conversation that was a humane conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And not a slap $20 or $10 on a table, let's go out in the back. That wasn't what we were doing. I mean, that wasn't, but we were also young people and surrounded by all of these things, including beautiful young women at mm-hmm. times. And I think that's part of the a lot of the conflict that was going on. But that moves me into another thought, and I just wanted to stress it, because I think there were only two kinds of people in Vietnam at any point, and those who spoke the language and those who didn't. And those who spoke the language knew how the Vietnamese thought, and they understood the culture, and they understood the dynamics of family and the dynamics of society. They understood the richness of the Vietnamese humor. They understood the strength of the Vietnamese character in the midst of the worst conditions, how they can find humor and how they can find sparks of hope. And they could understand that that happiness and sadness are not disassociated. The happiness and sadness are viewed as one. I mean, we look at happiness and sadness as two different things, as opposites. And the Vietnamese see happiness and sadness as one. It's a curious kind of thing. You cannot be happy without being sad, and you cannot be sad without being happy. And you have to know the language, and you have to know the culture, I think, to understand that they just look upon things a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
They treat death in a different kind of way. They expect much. It's not that they have that life is cheap, but they expect so much less. That to survive is understandable that children die young. It happens all the time. And so there's I I just felt that I had learned so much. I mean, looking back, Vietnam had gave me so much, much, much more than I ever gave to Vietnam, that it ended up being a kind of selfish experience. And through all of this, there were kinds of beacons of within our, if we were idealists, there were idealists among the idealists, and I was not an idealist among the idealists. Everyone had to look to someone else for support, and I looked to Don Luce and to Gene mm-hmm. Stolzwitz, and both of those people, Don because he seemed so uncompromised, and he seemed to have such great integrity, and he seemed to have such a deep, and he seemed to be so empathetic to the Vietnamese, that he seemed to have everything together. And Gene Stolzwitz, because he was so human and so hearty, and so, and his laugh and his fun, there was such a wholesomeness to Gene Stolzwitz. And these were two directors. And I would, you know, you'd say, you know, I'd be, it's like I would give my life for either one of them. They were just that kind of people. And so you could sort of, when you weren't sure of how you should be reacting or acting in a kind of certain circumstance, you could sort of look to them and you'd sort of instinctively know, you know, within this context, within this culture, within this setting, within this time, this is what would constitute a moral or a correct or a right approach. And we, as young idealists, were trying as best we could to live and to honor the culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that we all came to recognize that we were not making much of a difference, and that at most what we were doing is honoring the integrity of Vietnamese culture. And maybe that was enough. To what degree did we have to protest to maintain our own integrity became an individual matter. And as you know, a number of us signed the letter in protest, mm-hmm. And I signed that letter, but then there was also a group that felt that they were called upon to resign, and Don was one of them. But before Don did that, he asked me how I wanted to react to it, and I felt that I wanted to stay there, and I felt that, and he really encouraged me to stay, and he said, well, what might be a good idea for you would be for you to stay and travel around the country and learn as much as you can, and then communicate back to me, Don Luce, back in the United States, what the heck was going on. So what he did is he appointed me before he left to be director of the whole refugee operation in Vietnam.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And so he moved me out of Thuy Hoa, and that was, I think that was in after the Tet Offensive.
Well, he left before.
Okay, then it was before.
Because the letter was September 19th,
okay.
Of 67.
Okay, well, you have that. But then before he left, he appointed me, he asked me to leave and to become director of the refugee services. I mean, sort of, I don't know if that
kind
was...
Kind of a team leader sort of thing?
A kind of a team leader, you know, because to travel throughout the country mm-hmm. and to talk to all the people who are doing work with refugees in Vietnam, all the IBS people. And so I could go to all four corps, and it was in that capacity that I went to the Mekong Delta to check in on how, you know, they were doing in the Mekong Delta at the time of Gitelson's death.
Mm-hmm.
So then I would write my reports and send the reports back, make sure that Don Luce... So there, whether it was conspiratorial or it made perfect sense or whatever, but so Don asked me to stay on and to sort of to continue to be a presence to the refugees.
Probably made perfect sense in a way, because you would have gotten along well with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you promote people who you like, you know, as long as they're competent. So
yeah.
If you were competent, that's a given. And then if you liked you,
Well, Don and I always...
And had trust in your judgment.
I think that Don and I always got along very well, and he was like an older brother.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just trusted each other. I guess,
yeah.
I know I trusted him, and I suspect that he trusted me. And so...
I'm sure he does.
And so I stayed on, and then started traveling and doing the refugee reports. The Tet Offensive came, and that caused even greater problems.
Before you go to that,
yeah.
The actual formation of the letter,
yes,
didn't just sort of happen. I mean, there had to have been
right.
a lot of meetings and discussions and things like that. And I'd like to tap into the dynamics of people thinking, and you've got someone at the front door, so I'll pause this. Okay, this
is right. We're covering a lot of ground here.
We sure are.
I hope
yeah.
it's helpful.
No, it's very good. And sometimes, if there's not the time pressure, there's a tendency to drift off and tell some really neat stories,
yeah.
but to kind of drift off, and I'm sure
Can you
that,
tell me if I'm getting off?
Oh, no, you're not. No, yeah. no. I mean, with... Here, just to pause for a sec. Got this back on again. I was interested in the gestation of the
letter.
Of the discussions that went on, because it wasn't just the four who resigned, because there was also 33 like yourself
right.
who signed.
Right.
And how did this come about?
Is that how many signed? 33 signed?
I believe it was
yeah.
33.
Well, I think my guess is that John Summer wrote the primary draft. I don't think Don did. I think that Don and John worked together, but I think that at that time that Don was depending on John in a kind of way for some of the articulation of his own thoughts.
Okay.
And I think that I wasn't really part of the original writing of the letter because I wasn't in Saigon. But, you know, I would come into Saigon. And then, and I think that the genesis of the letter really was much more in Saigon. But I remember being shown the letter and asked if there are revisions or ideas, and I think I probably made, you know, I brought in some stuff, and I couldn't even tell you what. Don
mm-hmm.
might have a better idea on refugees from my experience, and so there was some language changes and tightening and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that
mm-hmm.
that I think I played a part in. That's my recollection, and that may not be true, but I think that's what happened. But I do remember more distinctly that there was, after the letter was written, there was the question of who was going to resign, and there it almost seemed divisive, as if the pure thing for everyone to do was resign.